At 17, Chantelle McDougall was nannying for a 36-year-old man. At 20, she was pregnant with his child and swept up in his bizarre spiritual beliefs. At 27, they all disappeared.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nanup 4, a story of control, manipulation and isolation. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
A few years ago, Stephanie Wood met a sweet guy online. Let's call him Joe. Joe was a sheep farmer, reinventing himself after a career as an architect. He had an ex-wife and two kids at school. Over romantic weekends away and fireside dinners, Stephanie fell in love. But things weren't perfect. Joe began cancelling plans right at the last minute, or would just not show up at all. Some of the stories he was telling about his business interests and his real estate deals didn't seem to quite add up. Eventually, Stephanie ended the relationship. She was heartbroken, but she started using her journalistic nous to look into the things that Joe had told her. What she uncovered was a dark, messy web of duplicity and manipulation. Stephanie is not alone. There are plenty of smart, confident, capable women out there being undone by men like Joe. Her book is called Fake. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello, how are you?
What was going on in your life back in 2014 before you met Joe?
I was very, very single. I'd been single for a number of years. I had dipped my toe in online dating waters a few years earlier and sort of, I describe it as a bit of a swamp in the book. And I'd left it. I'd decided, oh, I can't bear it. I can't bear it anymore.
Why? What was it when you say a swamp?
You're just not meeting men that are very appealing. And I know that men say this about it in reverse for when the women they're meeting, but for me, I just men that aren't quite right. One wanted to tell me all about the tantric sex ashram he'd been to in India,
and that's either going to be very
STD tests before he went into it. And I'm like, this is our first date. We're having a coffee, and this is what you want to talk about, right? Another one wanted to tell me about his ex-girlfriend's strange sexual habits, and these are first dates.
That don't become second dates.
They don't become second dates.
But what else was going on? I mean, you were working. You had
I was working at Good Weekend Magazine, which was then owned by Fairfax Media, now Nine. I was living in Sydney. I had a great social life. I'm extremely close to my brother and my sister-in-law and their kids, and it was fine. Any woman in my position would say it's lonely. I'd hit 40 and most of my contemporaries have children and their lives become very different, and it's quite exclusionary, but not deliberately so, but it is. And so you do find yourself alone a lot. I certainly did, and I'm quite introverted. So thankfully, that in a sense, that's a blessing because it makes it easier for me to be solitary. I was loving my job as a features writer at Good Weekend, the best job in the world. And I had the most amazing editor, Amelia Lester, who'd worked at The New Yorker. And actually, she came later. That's right. Sorry. I decided I'd go dating again online.
So what was it about Joe's profile
that you liked?
Well, he contacted
me, and very soon after I put my profile back up online, he contacted me, and he could write. He put apostrophes in the right place.
Grammar will get you every time.
Grammar gets you. That is a very rare thing. Men generally online don't write very eloquently, and he wrote very, very eloquently, and I was completely taken in by that. And he talked about his love for the country, for the bush, for nature, for his children, and I love the bush and I love nature. I don't get to it very often, unfortunately, but it was a very appealing package. He talked about having a boat that he sailed on the harbour. I love the water so much. And so that was before we met. Those were the things that he'd presented me with, and then we met.
And what was he like in person compared to that online profile?
He was awkward, a little bit awkward, the first date. I wasn't blown away at all, and I actually left thinking I probably won't see him again. He said something at the time that bothered me. He said, "You must be very well connected." And by that he meant because I'm a journalist and I know people in fairly wide circles, and I hate the idea of being well connected. Like, that's not me. I'm much happier digging in the soil of my community garden, as my friends will tell you. And I'm not interested in, you know,
social... Did you get the sense that he was maybe interested in using you as a way to get to other people?
Yes, that was my initial sense. I thought, you're an opportunist and you think I might... I didn't think through every possible ramification or implication of what that might have meant. But he did this thing that for the first time that I would see later in the relationship of backtracking. Oh, no, I said to him, I'm not well connected and I don't like that sort of, I'm not interested in that sort of world. And he said, oh, no, I'm not interested in someone well connected. I'm very, very private. I, you know, even when I was an architect, I wouldn't let my firm's work be published in architectural magazines. Oh, no. So it was a backtrack and it was weird, but I bought it. I thought, okay, that's fine.
Did he tell you much about his own life at that first date?
He talked a lot about the farm and the sheep, and I'm a journalist, and so I switch into journalism mode and I asked about sheep. I learn all about the sheep. And I think later he told me, oh, you ask quite intelligent questions about sheep. And I wasn't faking it because I love the idea of living on a farm and working with sheep. You know, perhaps that's naive of me, but it sounds quite appealing.
It's quite alluring. It's up there with the kind of fireman fantasy, the farmer.
It's a like, farmer fantasy. Of course, I had fantasized about farmers before. I don't apologise for that.
Was there a spark between you,
Stephanie? I felt there was. The second date, which I wasn't expecting would happen, but it did. I felt there was a spark, definitely, and I started to... But then there was another hitch between our second and third dates when we were talking about going out for dinner and I said, would you like me to book somewhere? And we're discussing restaurants. And because I'm a former restaurant reviewer and great food lover and cook and know restaurants, I feel quite knowledgeable. And he said, well, you make the decision and maybe you should book because it'll be really interesting to see how they treat you if it's under your name. And I again recoiled because that's one of my least favourite things to be recognised. Not that it happens very much anymore because I haven't been reviewing for a very long time, but I hate being recognised in a restaurant. I hate people fawning over me. And so again, I recoiled at that.
Was he asking you questions about you? And...
Well, that was an email conversation about the restaurant. But in hindsight, no. Not as much as you would ideally like in someone that was potentially interested in you. And I do remember one date that we had after we'd got together where I talked a lot about my father who, oh my God, I adore it. Dad died in 2010. Absolutely, he's my hero and very significant figure in my life. And of course I'm going to talk about my father. And later Joe said to me, you did talk a lot about your father. And in hindsight, I look back and go, you weren't really interested. You were sitting there not in the least interested in anything I had to say.
How soon after the two of you met did you decide to go away for a weekend together?
We had had four dates. And then he said, I'd very much like you to come away for a weekend with me. And I mean, this is what we're built for, isn't it? Love. I was pretty keyed up about that.
You use a Norwegian
word. That's
what is
right.
It?
It was a Norwegian word I found in a sort of a modern urban dictionary, I think, called forelsket. And I'm sure Norwegians will tell me I'm not pronouncing it correctly. But it means, it describes those incredibly heady, intense, wildly irrational early days of a relationship where you've lost your brain, really.
And you're just madly crushing on someone.
Madly crushing. And that was where I was at that stage. And then also anxiety. I suffer anxiety, not to a panic attack. I don't ever want to overstate because I know a lot of people suffer much more severely than I do. And I've suffered anxiety in certain relationships in the past. And around about then, the anxiety started to kick in
I guess those feelings can kind of overlap, can't they?
Exactly.
That excitement, butterflies in the stomach can be similar to anxiety.
Yes, exactly. And so it was very hard to pull apart the emotions and to know what was anxiety and what was forelsket and what was madness and what was what. And other emotions as the relationship wore on came into play as well. And I still have no idea how I can unpick those emotions and go, well, that was that and that was that. It's probably impossible.
Given that you'd only met a few times, were you nervous at all about going away on a weekend with him.
Oh, yeah, of course. I made sure I don't normally carry a lot of cash with me. I'm hopeless. I just use my credit card. But this particular weekend, I made sure I had hundreds of dollars of cash with me because I always like to pay my own way. And I was ready if I needed to flee this country cottage he'd booked that I'd checked where the nearest motel was. And I had cash ready to hand over to him to say, listen, I'm going to go. This isn't working. And I really want to pay my share of the weekend, which turned out not to be necessary.
Well, how did the weekend go?
It was blissful. I don't think I've ever been happier. It was heaven, little cottage, cute little cottage. His dog was tied outside, his beautiful dog. And I don't think we need to go into the details, but it was very special for me.
All aspects of the relationship were
explored. And but there was one funny moment when I went for a walk. There was a moment of awkwardness on the I think it was a Saturday morning when I woke up and I wasn't, you know, that sort of post now we're vertical, what do we do now sort of moment. And it was like I went for a walk in the garden and I found this little cottage, an open little shack sort of thing in the garden, and went inside. And it turned out that the owners of the property had built a little heritage kind of bush museum, and it had old pioneer photos and old pioneer equipment, including an axe on the wall. And he came in behind me, my Joe, and put his arms around me, I think, and I think I made a joke about the axe. You know, you could be an axe murderer. I've got no idea who you are.
So after things went so well on that first weekend, what were the next few weeks and months like?
It was heady. I was beside myself, deliriously happy. I mean, it had been so long since I'd been with someone, and as I write in Fake, the personal pronoun we and I are very powerful personal pronouns, and I'd been an I for so long, and it's actually, I wonder if other people feel this, but I'm so acutely aware when people go, we're going away this weekend, we are going to a restaurant. I hear it, and I heard it then and I still hear it now very acutely. And all of a sudden I was a we are going to stay on the Hawkesbury River this weekend. We are going to dinner. We are going to the theatre. And that was so wonderful. And he seemed loving and gentle and very kind, and I just so loved being with him.
How much did he share about the rest of his life with you?
A lot. He talked a lot. Now, in hindsight, I can see that he really wasn't very interested in asking me very much about myself. My understanding was that he'd had a very difficult divorce from his ex-wife, who he told me was quite mad. And needed medication and didn't always stay on the medication. And when she wasn't on the medication, she was very irrational. He had two children who he adored. He lived on the harbour in a house that he'd designed and built himself with the children. He had 1 week custody with them. Then they went to their mother. When he didn't have custody, he spent a few days with me and then went to the farm. He claimed to have this farm in the country with just a shack, not a house, just a shack. And he'd sent me photographs of the shack, which was a very, very rudimentary dwelling, and described it in text messages in such vivid detail. And he described the country and going slashing and fixing fences and shooting foxes and slashing sifton weed. And he painted this incredibly vivid portrait of his rural life, which, as I said earlier, I thrilled to. It was like, oh, my God, I want to be there. Can I take a thermos of coffee to him?
What about the house on the harbour with his kids? Did you ever go and visit him
there?
Well,
this became the biggest issue in the relationship, I suppose, and also the reason it ended. He wouldn't show it to me initially, and the excuses unfolded. Initially, it was because we're only very new in the relationship. Then it became my mother's staying with me because she's having the floorboards of her harbourside apartment repolished, and the fumes of the polish are giving her migraines, so she's staying with me for a while. Then it became, I'm moving out, everything's packed up because I'm renovating it so that the teenagers, my grown kids, can have more space when they're teenagers. So everything's packed up. Besides, it gives me really unhappy memories. I don't like to be there except when the kids are there. Then it became, I can't have you there unless they're there, and they're not ready for that because it's our cocoon. It was where we sort of all bunkered down after the divorce. So the excuses unfolded. There was one night we drove past it and he pointed it out and I thought he was going to take me in and he said, no, the kids aren't there. They've got to be there to welcome you as well. It's their house too. And I was really uncomfortable with this. I knew that it was not a good sign, but I felt I was in a very difficult, fragile situation because I assumed that what he told me was true about the difficult divorce, and I thought these children are damaged, he's damaged, they're very, very fragile, and I need to be very gentle here. I can't go blundering in and demanding, which isn't my nature anyhow, but I can't blunder in and be demanding, and I need to be very polite and very gentle and calm. I told him it was a deal breaker, but. And he said, I understand that, but it kept on spinning out and out and out.
Did he introduce you to his kids?
Yes, I did meet the children briefly twice. I met them over a Thai dinner, which I can look back, I think he probably ended it, Joe probably ended it prematurely because I'd started to ask the kids questions about moving between I was grappling for conversation with these two young kids and I bumbled along in the conversation. I was so nervous trying to sort of think of things to talk about. And I asked a question asked the daughter a question about, is it, tricky to remember to take everything between your mum and dad's houses? And he, I think, heard that. And I suspect the next thing I know, the son is in the toilet being sick and the son's sick and he's got to get his son home because the son's really sick. Now I look back, I go, that was a bit odd how that night ended.
When did he start cancelling plans?
That actually happened fairly early, but there were always, what seemed like on the face of it, incredibly plausible reasons. Lots connected to the farm. A bore needed drilling out. And, I don't know anything about bores. That sounded reasonable. And I actually have since asked friends that do have a farm and they go, no, that's feasible. I'm not giving these in any order because they were just this chaotic number of cancellations hurled at me over the 15-month period of our relationship. Semi-trailer carrying sheep had tipped over and it was chaos. His dog had been bitten by a snake. He'd been poisoned by sheep drench. He had an infected jaw. His daughter had concussion. His son had concussion. His daughter had broken collarbone. I mean, it just was endless. And with every cancellation, my anxiety grew. I was a wreck. I was becoming an absolute wreck.
Was there a kind of pattern to the timing of the cancellation? Like, would you get much notice?
Not much notice. Very rarely any notice. But the pattern of the cancellations was the completely extraordinary, elaborate nature of the cancellations. They'd be little, I've described them in the book as three-act plays. There'd be the one announcing, oh, I might have a problem here. Very rarely did he cancel just say, I can't come. I'll see you next week. It would be, might have a problem, I'll try and get there later. And then it would build and build and build. And, for example, the dog being bitten by a snake started on Friday night when he was meant to be coming to my place and I was cooking dinner for him. And it went for 3 days. So him building the saga about how he was moving the dog to a vet friend of his in the country. The dog was clinging to life. The dog was looking better. He was cradling the dog's head in his lap, and the dog's eyes were frightened. And
you can't be angry at someone if their beloved dog is.
I'm just saying, do what you need to do. Stay there. It's okay. I'm all right. I loved the dog. The dog was gorgeous. And I was saying, let me know how she's going.
What happened on the evening that you wanted to introduce him to your family for the first time?
That was before Christmas in 2014. And, of course, that was when you introduce a boyfriend to a family, that's momentous. And it had been quite a few years since I'd had a boyfriend to introduce to a family. So it was a very special occasion. And he'd got me one of his legs of lamb, allegedly from his alleged sheep, and I have kettle barbecue that not a gas one, it's one where you actually have to build the fire, which I was not very proficient at, and he loved his fires, and so I assumed he'd come along and help me with that part of the process, and he didn't turn up in the early part of the afternoon, and I set my barbecue alight because Yeah, not being very proficient at barbecuing. And I sent a photograph of him, of the barbecue, to the fiery barbecue, the conflagration, to Joe. I said, what do I do now? What's going on? He said, you've allowed it to have too much air. Shut it down, shut it down. So I did what he told me to do. And he said, I'm on my way. I'm coming. He just never, ever turned up. And I tried to call him and the phone didn't answer. And he just didn't turn up. My family and I sat there shaking at dinner.
What did your family say to you?
Oh, well, we're very close. I can't remember, to be honest. I think everyone was a bit disappointed. And
probably trying to reassure you.
Probably. I was a mess, though, because of the anxiety hit me. And all I can do in those situations is I curl up in a ball and I'm just... It's not quite shaking, but it's just these rippling, horrible feelings running through you. And that's what I did. And so it was a horrible night.
You were also writing lists in your head.
Yeah.
What lists were you composing?
I don't know where I'd got this idea from. Maybe my psychologist had suggested this. I honestly can't remember. But I thought, I've got to put down all of the reasons why I am worrying about nothing. This is ridiculous. And so I would write lists why he's not lying to me. And at that point, I think the worst that I imagined was perhaps he's not into me. Perhaps he just really doesn't like me, which was a pretty devastating thought. Or perhaps he's with another woman. And so I'd write these lists why he's not lying to me. And now I read them back. It's because he said he was imagining me with grey hair in a farmhouse kitchen. Because he said. And it was all about the things he said. It wasn't the things he did. And that now in hindsight should have been a bit of a warning sign to me.
Did he ever ask you for money?
No, never, never. And he paid for things. I mean, it wasn't lavish expenditure. We went away now, I think we went away for three lovely weekends, gorgeous weekends. I really loved him so much. And they weren't lavish though, they were mainly cottages, but nice places. And he took me to dinner, and I have to confess to some, being a former restaurant reviewer, my restaurant tastes are not cheap, I'm sorry. And he'd pay for taxis, he'd tip the taxi drivers. He always would pull wads of money out of his wallet and tip taxi drivers, and I'd go, oh, my God, you're generous. And he'd say, oh, they have such a raw deal. And, you know, the picture built more of this gentle, kind man.
What was Happy Valley, Stephanie?
Happy Valley emerged probably seven or eight months into the relationship. And by that stage, I'd never seen the little block of land. I think he said he had 200 acres of land down on the south of Sydney. I never saw that land with the rustic shack on it because he sold it, he told me. He said, I really have decided I want to get into farming on a much bigger scale. I want to do this, this and this. And the plans were glorious and glamorous and I was fascinated by them. So he sold his little place and told me that he was interested in making offers on a very large, very impressive property south of Sydney again. And this property was, the extent of it was such that it was listed on the Sotheby's website. It was not a sort of place that you wander in on a Saturday morning and do a bit of tire kicking. You go there by appointment only. It was fundamentally a mansion in the French provincial style. And it had orchards and a vegetable parterre, which is like one of those circular, and I so love growing vegetables. And I was like, oh my God, this is heaven.
But did you get to see it or did he just tell you about it?
No, he did. He told me about it for a long time and then eventually he took me there. And by that stage, I had got so used to there being cancellations that I thought, he's not going to show me this, that there's something going on. By that stage, I had actually started to think, perhaps he's a fantasist. Maybe that's what's going on. And I didn't even really know then what a fantasist was. Like, it really hadn't entered I thought I was a fairly well-read and well-rounded person, but hadn't really entered my lexicon. And he took me to see this property and we drove in into this property, Happy Valley, up its sort of gravel driveway and rolled in and the peacocks are strutting around and the guinea fowl and I picked up some guinea fowl feathers and woo. And we went in, I met the owner who was not well at the time and sitting in a bedroom, not looking very well. And then his wife came and whisked me away through this grand tour of this incredible property. Like the, its fireplaces, multiple fireplaces, were bigger than my bathroom.
So was that part, was that kind of a carrot for you, that imagined future with him? Is that part of what kept you there, do you think?
Yes. To be really honest, yes. I thought I was in love with him, but I was also in love with the idea of this romantic rural future. I wasn't terribly interested in money, but I did love the idea of living with a man that I loved on a farm.
What did your friends think about him?
Not many of my friends met him because he cancels so often. So there were many occasions when he was due to meet my friends and he didn't turn up. My family met him, my mother met him, my brother met him, my sister-in-law and the kids. Later they'd tell me they thought he was a bit odd, but at the time they were telling me stop worrying because I was sharing my anxiety, saying, oh, why is he doing this and what's going on? And I'd bore them to tears with my anxieties and they would say, stop worrying, you're going to ruin it. And other friends would say to me, it's fine, stop worrying, it's fine. And I also talked at length to my psychologist about it. Her conclusion was she wasn't seeing any red flags, that a man with two children, a difficult ex-wife, lots of different business interests, as he told me he had, farms, that was a complex life and a lot of balls were in the air and it was understandable that things happened in that life.
Joe came into your brother's work one day. What was he doing?
It was a night he was meant to come to my place for dinner again and he cancelled in the afternoon with a very, very complex story that I won't go into. And all of a sudden I get a text message from Joe and he says, we're at this restaurant, which is the restaurant my brother works at. Your brother's looking after us so well. And my brother had taken them complimentary champagne.
Who was he there with?
Well, he was there. He told me in the text message he was there with his sister.
What did your brother tell you about meeting that? Did he think there was anything weird about Joe being there with someone else?
No. I texted my brother in a state of... I was very, very anxious about it. And the next morning, I didn't want to disturb my brother while he was still working, but the next morning I texted him and said, well, who was he there with? What happened? What happened? Tell me all about it. And my brother was short-tempered with me and said, oh, of course it was his sister. I overheard them talking about their mother.
Don't be hysterical.
Don't be hysterical.
You were invited to a wedding in Townsville in 2015. Did Joe agree to go with you?
And I didn't want to push him. I mean, the whole relationship, it was a pattern of my behaviour in the relationship to be understanding and gentle, really suppressing my own personality. Well, I am an understanding and gentle person, but I really were, you know, many occasions when I should have had every reason to be furious, I stifled that instinct of anger, which is what women the world over do, isn't it? And it's a lesson for me and I think for possibly other people as well. But I didn't push him to the wedding. I just said, you know, I'd love you to come with me. And again, it seemed like a real milestone in a relationship to take your boyfriend to a friend's wedding. And eventually he said, yes, I'm coming. I can come. And he sat next to me on the couch. I said, do you want me to book the flight? We were at my place this night when he said he would come. And I said, do you want me to book the flight for you? Oh, no, I'll do it, he said, and pulled out his mobile phone. And I guess I took so much for granted. I didn't think, I think probably then you could book a flight on a mobile phone. And I was sitting with my laptop and I was telling him the flight details and so and what seat number I had and so forth. And he fiddled with his phone for a period of time. And I can't even remember how long. I wasn't examining him suspiciously. I just assumed he was doing what he said he did. And that was that, as far as I... And then on the morning of the day we were to fly, he stayed over the night before at my place and we kissed each other goodbye in the morning and he said, I'll go home and get my suit and take the dog to the vet, which presumably was going to, you know, a vet hotel kind of a thing. And I'll see you at your place tonight and we'll fly tomorrow morning.
What happened?
In the afternoon, I got a message. He rang me and said that he was changing his mind about buying Happy Valley and was buying a completely different property. He was at the lawyer's. He was taking the dog for a walk. And I said, you were going to take the dog to a vet hotel. Sorry, that you were going to do that at lunchtime. What? Oh, I got confused. And, of course, it was a red flag. But by that stage, I was a bit of a mess. And I don't think I was functioning very well to see... You haven't taken the dog to the vet. You're changing the property that you're buying. None of this is make... I knew subliminally it didn't make any sense whatsoever, but I don't think I had the capacity to sort of set it out. And by setting it out, that meant something very ugly as well.
Did he end up making it to the wedding?
No. So he didn't turn up that night because the lawyer's meeting went late. And then his ex-wife had not turned up to pick his son up from the school disco. He had to go and get his son, and he was going to drop the son back to the ex-wife's house. No sign of the ex-wife. I have to stay here tonight. Next morning, I'm on my way to your place now. Sorry about all this. Half an hour later, oh, I can't. Everything's going belly up here. I'm going to make it, though. Go to the airport without me. And just this, again, act one, act two, act three of the text message exchange. And I went to the airport on my own, and I flew to Townsville on my own. And I was catatonic. It was just the most awful, awful thing.
Was that a kind of final straw for you?
Not quite, no. And there should have been many final straws now, looking back. I should have told him it was over when he didn't turn up for the lunch with my family, but I forgave him at the time. I still was believing his story, substantially believing his story. I was uneasy. Of course I was uneasy about what was going on, but I was on the face of it believing his story that his ex-wife was causing all these problems and the children were in a state. He sent me a message, "I'm so sorry about this. I need to devote some time to the children. I haven't been giving them the attention they need. I can't talk now. There's too much happening. I'll be in touch." And for 3 weeks, he would not talk to me on the phone. He wouldn't take my calls. I'd send a text message saying, "How are you? What's going on?" And he would reply days and days later. For a lot of that, I tried to work, but I eventually ended up on my mother's couch. I flew from Sydney to Queensland to curl up in a ball on my mother's couch. And I got an email. I decided I had to get back to Sydney to work because I was, you know, it was affecting my work. I was having to take sick leave from work, and that's a terrible thing. That his behaviour should have affected my profession and my career like that. And I decided I had to go back to work. And on the day that I was going back, I got an email from him saying, "Now I know that I love you. Now I know that I really love you. I'm working a few things out, but I really love you." And so it put me back on that path of hope, addicted to hope, I talk about. And I went back to Sydney, and I kept on saying, "I've got to see you. Will you come and talk to me about what's going on? Are you okay? I'm worrying about you." And eventually he turned up at my place about 3 weeks after the wedding and looked a mess, looked a complete and utter mess, and said to me in a broken voice, "Oh, what have I done to you?" Because I'd lost a lot of weight. I was a mess too. And we reconciled for about 10 days, 12 days. Breaking up's hard to do. And I said to him, "I've got to see your house." And he said, "I know. Come over tomorrow night." And I don't think I even got excited. I think I was past any form of, it was like, this has got to be done. And once it's done, then I can make a reassessment of what happens then. And on the day of the day I was meant to be going to his house for dinner with the children, a message came in from, a text message, most excuses were via text message, saying, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. My daughter forgot to tell me there's an event at the school I've got to take her to tonight." And I wasn't even surprised. I think I went back to bed and I was such a mess. And he said, "Come over tomorrow night." And I thought, right, okay. And the next day the excuse came, my dog's had an attack of gastro. He even sent me a packet of medication with that day's date on it from a vet in his neighbourhood for a dog's medication.
But you had had enough by this point.
Well,
Stephanie.
I had, but I was just not really very capable of functioning. I probably wasn't far off being admitted to a psychiatric ward. In hindsight, thankfully, I didn't have to do that. But I had a friend, a male friend, who'd been the one friend I had who'd been for a long time saying, "How long are you going to let this go on for?" A heterosexual bloke who could probably, even without all the details, know that this was not the way a relationship should be unfolding. He came over to my place one morning, dragged me out of bed, sat me on the couch, shoved some pastries at me I hadn't eaten for days, and said, "You've got to end this." And I said, "I know." And I got myself I love the ocean, as I talk about a lot in the book, and I somehow got myself to my favourite. Sydney is full of beautiful sea baths, ocean pools, and I got myself to the ladies' baths, which are my favourite in Coogee. and had a swim, felt a little bit better, went home and sent an email saying it was over.
After you'd ended it with Joe, who did you reach out to on Facebook?
It's a very complex story, but I reached out to someone he had once mentioned, a mutual acquaintance, someone we both knew. And this person and I were friends on Facebook, but that's that we you most of us use that word friends very lightly these days, because if you're a professional, you do use Facebook as a networking thing. And so I reached out to this person on Facebook and said, "Do you know this man?"
And what did she tell you?
She said, "Oh my God, he's been going out with a friend of mine for 3 years."
What did you find out next?
The discoveries unfolded over a long period of time after that. I think I possibly only had the capacity to absorb so much at one time. But that night, with a friend on the another friend on the phone from Melbourne, one of my best friends in Melbourne, we sat on the phone and went through together this woman's Facebook page, the other woman, Kirsty, I describe her in the book. And at that stage, this was late 2015, I think we were a little bit less concerned about privacy with our social media back then. And her pages, both Instagram and Facebook, were open. And she'd posted a lot of photographs, if not of him, with hints of him or his dog in the photograph. And so I was able to see, putting together her Instagram and Facebook, that almost every time he'd lied to me about dogs and sheep and children, he was with her.
What sort of details could you see on those images that you recognised?
Oh, some of them he was there, front and centre, face and everything. But others I would see his hand. You come to know someone, the geography of someone's hand, when you have been with them for 15 months. And he had large hands. I loved them. Big, solid, lovely hands. And his hand would be sitting in the corner of a photograph or the corner of at a restaurant table, for example, the corner of a sleeve of a shirt that I'd given him, for example. So those sorts of signs in photographs, but also a lot of him. And the most devastating of all of them, I think, was the weekend that I spent worrying about his dog that had been bitten by a snake. He was at a series of resorts with this other woman. He went from the Central Coast to the Hunter Valley with her. And there were photographs of him that she'd taken sitting on a veranda at one of these resorts, reading the book I'd given him only weeks earlier for his birthday, Don Watson's The Bush, in the pool, having breakfast.
Was there any record of that night that he'd gone to the restaurant where your brother worked?
Yes. I found pictures on this woman's Facebook feed of the dumplings from this particular restaurant.
So it was her. It wasn't his sister.
It wasn't his sister. He'd taken her there.
Stephanie, this is just, it must have been the most hideous series of discoveries. How on earth were you making sense of it? What was going on in your head? I can't imagine I was at the time.
In a way, I don't think I was surprised. How could I have been, I'd been so worried for so long. I don't think I was actually surprised, but that said, it was gobsmacking at the same time. I don't think emotions always have easy words to describe them.
You must have been thinking, why? Why mm-hmm. such an elaborate double life?
I know. I was. I couldn't, because he'd never asked me for money. I didn't understand. If he didn't love me, why was he with this? Why didn't he just go to this other woman? And she'd been there from the first day of our relationship. She was never not there.
What else did you find out about him once you started digging with some of your colleagues at the Herald?
Well, this is one of the great, great blackly humorous moments in retrospect, that I sat about two desks away from the wonderful Kate McClymont, the Sydney Morning Herald's wonderful, extraordinary investigative journalist who brought down the New South Wales government, who saw Eddie Obeid into jail. And Kate is wonderful. She was at the launch of my book last night. And I also sat near another investigative journalist, Anne Davies, another wonderful investigative journalist and a good friend of mine. And during the relationship, Anne had said to me, "Come on, we've got to do some searches on him." And I'd Googled him during the relationship, and I'd established certain things were true about his stories. But I knew the searches that Anne meant, and they were things like title deed searches and bankruptcy searches. And I pushed myself on my chair back to my desk, and I said, no, this is a love story. I'm not being a journalist here. This is a love story. I can't do that. And after I dumped him, I obviously had the... I did those searches reasonably quick. I mean, it took me a while. Christmas was in the middle of it, and there was still a lot of time I was spending under a duvet with a pillow over my head. And I certainly took some Valium during that time.
What was revealed about him when you did those searches?
The first phone call I made was to the man he'd claimed was his ex-business partner in the architectural firm, and certainly this man was his ex-business partner. I refer to him as Peter in the book. And when I told Peter why I was ringing, and I was shaking as I made the call, Kate McClymont in the background egging me on, Peter's first words were, he's a compulsive liar. And then over through the conversation, he revealed just extraordinary details about what had gone down in their business. And he hadn't retired from architecture. The business had collapsed under the weight of debt. I round about that same time I did a search to discover that my ex had been bankrupt at the time I was with him, hence why he used cash. I'd once asked him, why don't you have a credit card? And he said, oh, I hate the banks, I'm not giving them any money, which that's not an uncommon sentiment, is it? But now I can see you can't get a credit card when you're bankrupt.
What about Kirsty, the woman that he'd been seeing at the same time as you? Was he still appearing on her Facebook and
Instagram pages? I did keep an eye on her feed for some months, and he would appear sporadically, not very often.
How would you feel when you saw him?
That was so
this
hard.
This life because, still going on.
Oh, it was awful. It was a feeling of jealousy and anger and that mix of emotions of green-eyed rage. And I had started to see who he really was, that he wasn't at all the man I'd thought he was. But human emotions are not logical creatures, are they?
When did you finally contact her?
I spent most of 2016 in a state of recovery. And I think by the middle of the year I was pretty good. I went to India on a trip. I didn't do anything sort of new agey, but maybe the effects were subliminal. But I had my 50th birthday, which was glorious, and friends from all over the country came to my place for a party. And then in early 2017, Amelia Lester started as editor of Good Weekend, and she'd come from The New Yorker, and we went for lunch and talked about story ideas, which is my favourite thing to do. I just love telling great, great, interesting human stories in my journalism. And we had lunch, and we talked about this and that and other stories, and we were walking back to the office, and I said, there is another story that I could write. She said, oh, yes, please tell me. And I burst into tears as I started to tell it. And she said, I don't think you're ready quite yet, but when you are, I want to publish that story. And so in, I think, April 2017, my story in Good Weekend was finally published about my farmer, my faux farmer. And... 3 days before publication, I called Kirsty because I decided she couldn't possibly read the article without having had some warning that it was coming.
God, what a conversation that must have been.
I've never made such a difficult phone call in all my life.
How did she respond?
Disbelieving at first. She now tells me that she thought I was some crazy stalker or troll. She didn't believe me, and she kept on saying, but she hadn't seen his house either. And so gradually through, we ended up, I think, speaking for 3.5 hours that day.
It's probably his worst nightmare that the two of you should that conversation.
I didn't want to give him worst nightmares. I just needed to understand what had happened.
When you met with Kirsty, what pieces of the jigsaw could you put together for one another?
Well, we did a lot of calendar cross-checking and looking at dates and the times that he'd cancelled on her, he was with me. She's very funny. She's a wonderful woman. She joked to me one day that she thought he must have had a whiteboard with two columns on it and different coloured marker pens, perhaps. And so I've got this picture of him now at his whiteboard with two columns, and one for me and one for her, and what stories he'd told me and what stories he'd told her. And interestingly, he'd never, ever mentioned his architectural background to her.
So he'd spun the story slightly differently.
Slightly differently. Like, he talked a lot to both of us about this cafe he adored in the little town near his old farm with the shack. And he told me that he thought the coffee was the best coffee in the country. He told Kirsty that he loved its chops. So it's like, what? It's next level madness.
And
it really is.
Did she remember? I mean, this is just one detail I know, but it seems so striking. Did she remember the night where he'd taken her to that restaurant where your brother worked?
Yes.
And passed her off as his sister?
Well, I think what happened was she must have been walking a little bit behind him. My brother must have escorted them to the bar. They sat at the bar in this very large restaurant, wonderful restaurant. And so Joe must have been walking with David. Maybe it's a busy, noisy, noisy restaurant. And he must have been walking a little bit ahead, and that's when he must have said, it's my sister. So she wouldn't have heard that. And then my brother was doing what my brother does so beautifully, you know, giving people who are important in the restaurant a glass of champagne, some complimentary appetizers.
So the fact that Joe risked that, it wasn't just that he was desperate to keep you out of each other's lives. Was there some thrill for him in being so close to exposure?
I think I'd have to say yes. I'm sure there was an adrenaline rush for him, but I mean, I would love to get inside the corridors of his mind, because it remains. I think I understand some things, but
what do you understand? What do you think was motivating it?
It wasn't money. One of the things I did soon after I broke off with him was do a search on Google for the words pathological liar and boyfriend. And what came up was a world of the most extraordinary stories I've ever seen that I could never have imagined was out there. What it led me to was the discovery that men who behave as Joe did often, and I can't diagnose him, but often have personality disorders, either narcissistic personality disorder or antisocial personality disorder, which have a whole spectrum and series of characteristics that immensely fascinating. And risk-taking is one of the behaviours that is very typical of these people.
Once you wrote that article in the Herald, Stephanie, did he get in touch with you?
Yes, he did. On the morning that the article came out, a very odd message, apologising, but not apologising. It was a strange, mixed-up combination of, I suppose I deserved that, but I'm happy now, I'm with someone and she understands me and I've told her everything. It was a very strange email.
What about letters from other people? What kind of response did you get from readers?
I think that's what led me to write a book, the response. You don't generally, as a journalist, get enormous response. And as you would know, some stories just hit a trigger, and this one did. And the outpouring was extraordinary on social media, into my inbox. I just could not keep up with the number of emails and messages that were coming in. And they were kind of roughly divided into three sections. Probably a third of them were people saying, what an incredible story. I'm so sorry you had to go through that experience. Wow, what a Hitchcockian sort of story that was. And some of them were, a few of them were people who recognised some of the characteristics I described, his dog, his four-wheel drive, and said, I know who you're talking about, including family members, his family members.
What did his family say?
They were very sorry that this was not the first time in their lives that they'd had to deal or heard this story. And they were very sorry that I had to go through that experience. But by far the bulk of the responses, I would say, were from people saying, thank you, that happened to me. Women and men, some men, saying, I was with a character like that, it broke me. And the trauma that people that have been in these relationships go through is absolutely immense. I mean, you can't compare one relationship breakdown with another, you know, but these relationships seem to have a very special capacity to wreak havoc. And often there's financial havoc. I was very fortunate that he didn't ask me for money and I didn't give him any money. So financially I wasn't the worse off for it. But a lot of people lose a lot of money, or they have children with these people and then have a life ahead of them where they've got to engage with that person.
Did it leave you with a sense of shame?
Yes. Yes, deep sense of shame. And it was the main reason I didn't want to write about it publicly. And it was extraordinarily difficult to do that initial Good Weekend article. And on the Friday afternoon in the newsroom, and I was such an anxious mess as I knew it was getting closer to publication. And someone said it's on the website. It's gone up on that, because often the Herald will put stories from the Saturday paper up on this Friday. And I think I nearly fainted on the newsroom floor. And that's a combination of fear of what's going to happen, what the outcome of this decision to write this story will be, and a sense I'm embarrassed. I was fooled.
Has that eased, though, now, as the time has gone by and you can see?
It has, because, partly because of the support I've received from people. It's been this immense outpouring of support from people that didn't know the story, friends, colleagues, acquaintances, but also people that I've never met in my life, but also other people that have been in the same situation. We've been in this together, in a sense. And also, finally, the most important thing probably is the research I did for the book, because it's not just my memoir. I've woven in research from anthropologists and psychiatrists and cognitive scientists and other people's stories. I've understood what our brain does to contribute to us making decisions that might not always be in our best interests.
Thank you, Stephanie. It takes a lot of courage, and you spoke about it so eloquently. Thank you for sharing your story on Conversations.
Thank you.
I spoke with Stephanie Wood in 2019, and since we spoke, her book Fake has been made into an acclaimed TV series starring Asha Keddy. And Stephanie is now one of the most successful Australian writers on Substack. Check out her newsletter there called Vamp. This conversation was produced on the lands of the Gadigal, Turrbal and Yagara peoples. The executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.